It'll be fun, man. It's going to be fun.
It'll still be fun. Yes, you are right.
When do you leave?
Friday. Well, we fly out on Friday to Detroit, fly back.
Are we starting? Or is this just... Yeah.
We got 4 minutes, 4.5 minutes of the song.
Yeah, there's plenty of time here to...
We got
nothing but time.
I can hear me, too.
You can hear it?
Yeah, it's
true. All right, good. So, yeah.
Trying to think of all the times like I've heard this song and what situations I've been in.
Yeah.
I don't know,
It's
so many places.
I can't think of another song that went from not relatable at all to the most relatable thing in the world.
Just through your life experience.
Yeah, like I listened to this song as a kid and I was like, it sounds good, but I don't know what he's saying. What's he talking about being in a mold? I'm like, oh my god, this is my life. No.
Can't change your mold, man.
No.
For me, no matter what, I think it was Now That's What I Call Music or something.
Oh, yeah.
I had one of those and it was on there, but still, no matter what, it's Cruel Intentions. The movie Cruel Intentions?
Yeah, oh, with Sarah Michelle Gellar.
Oh, yeah, and Ryan Felipe and Reese Witherspoon.
Right, what about that?
Oh,
is
man.
This in that?
Holy shit, it's the end sequence. Like,
oh,
Reese Witherspoon
shit.
Gets shoved out of the way of a car by Ryan Felipe.
Oh my god, that's right,
he dies.
Spoiler
and
alert.
So there's a, yeah. If you're listening,
our Venn diagram of Cruel Intentions, people that haven't seen Cruel Intentions that are fans of the show, the Venn diagram is just one circle.
Pretty much. That's the one person who's a fan of the show.
Yep.
Well, also, if they haven't seen it, they've had fucking almost 20 years to get on it. So, I mean, you missed out. If you didn't see that, I'm guessing you didn't see Simply Irresistible starring the young Sarah Michelle Gellar as well. I was into her.
I can see this song being in so many romantic comedies.
Oh, yeah. This, though, was used so... just epically at the end, because like Sarah Michelle Gellar is giving a speech at his funeral and they're like zooming in slowly on Ryan Felipe's picture in the background as everyone's like starting to like whisper and talk about Sarah Michelle Gellar, and they realize Reese Witherspoon took his journal and printed out all of the information about how terrible her character was, and so she printed it off and gave it to everybody. So she's like giving a speech about her dead brother even though she didn't actually care for him, and then she exposes her and like they find out she's got coke in her like cross that she wears.
Oh,
and
my
like
God.
It's all in slow motion and just keeps cutting back to Reese Witherspoon just driving in his convertible like over some bridge, just like letting her hair go. Like,
oh, I remember that. I remember that sequence.
So I hear it and I think of like school dances and I don't know.
And Reese Witherspoon getting away with it.
Yeah, basically. Just Reese Witherspoon driving around like a 1950s convertible. That's every time I hear this song.
That's very funny. Kyle, any memories tied to this song that you can think of?
I think of the auditorium at my high school for whatever reason. I want to say that this was like played at a like battle of the bands or something, but that couldn't possibly be. Could it? Other than that, was this on the OC or something?
I could see Seth Cohen getting down with the Verve.
I could see that. I don't know, though. It was like... This came out in 97.
This came out in 97. So I was 6 years old. For me, I was hanging out with my uncle a lot at the time.
Right.
And so he was big on this song. Whenever it came on the radio, he would tell me to listen to it. And then he also bought me a copy of Whatever and Ever Amen by Ben Folds 5. And that started my super love for them, which is a story for another day. But yeah, he always pointed out this song as like one of his favorites. And I listened to him for things music.
Sure.
So this reminds me of childhood a lot.
Funny.
It's a ubiquitous song, though.
Yeah.
I think everybody ties something to this song.
Oh, yeah. Do you know, like, the controversy behind this?
Oh, yeah.
Something with the Rolling Stones, right? I actually didn't get to that part when I was researching today.
Oh, yeah, no. So they, if you look it up, they're actually, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards are credited as songwriters on this.
Mm-hmm.
Because this symphony sound, like the actual orchestral sound, is a cover of The Last Time by Rolling Stones.
Oh.
But it sounds so different because last time's like, this would be the last time. Like, so to hear that transition into a symphony version played by an orchestra, they took that sample and they thought they had paid off. They paid off the people who had produced that symphony part, like the orchestra part, but they did not pay off Rolling Stones. They didn't even think about it. So before they had to release the album, they had to get permission. They did not get permission. They instead had to make them credited as songwriters, even though They literally had nothing to do with it. Mick Jagger and
Holy shit. Had
nothing to do with the production of the song, the lyrics, anything to do with it. So, yeah, they got millions of dollars, and they got nominated for
a Grammy.
A Grammy, yeah. A Grammy. They were tied to the nomination.
For Best Rock Song. Yeah. Hold that thought. I want to keep talking about this song because this is all awesome. Welcome to another episode of One Hit Wonderful World. This is episode 4. My name is Cody Nelson. I'm with some other people here. Please introduce yourselves, the man to my left.
My name is Kyle Kimblin.
Kyle Kimblin is the other co-host. And we are with the third voice, MJ Marsh. He is our guest today. Welcome, MJ. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, guys. This is fun.
Awesome. Already. I'm glad we're already having a blast. Off to a great start.
I just remembered Cruel Intentions 2 was a thing that became a movie.
Hey, don't let it get bad. Don't talk about Cruel Intentions 2.
Hey, what about 3? That's got to be out there.
There's 3 of them?
Of course,
there are 3 of them.
I'm guaranteeing there is.
So,
Land Before Time.
What we're doing here today is we're talking about a one-hit wonder. That's the premise of the show. Each week we highlight a different one-hit wonder, and we do a couple of things with it. We talk about the song that got them big. We talk about kind of where they were as a band, as a whole, at large, like over the course of their career. But mostly we focus on the album that they made after the album that had the hit on it. So we talk about Bittersweet Symphony. We're also going to be talking to, talking a lot about an album called Fourth that they put out in 2008. We'll talk about what happened in that year gap. But if you want to get the full experience of this podcast, take a listen to the album. It's on Apple Music, Spotify, all that stuff. It's pretty good.
It's good.
Yeah.
It's definitely a 2008 British rock album.
Yep. I wrote here...
Hold on. Let's give a little bit of background. So yeah. Bittersweet Symphony is on an album called Urban Hymns. Urban Hymns. And that came out in 1997. As MJ was already saying... this song was credited to Mick Jagger and Keith Richards after the fact, as well as Richard Ashcroft,
the singer of the Verve.
Yeah.
The Verve ends up breaking up, and Richard Ashcroft has a solo career, and then they get back together after how many years?
10 years to record. 11 yep. to the release.
So they released this album, Fourth, 11 years after Urban Hymns, after breaking up, after the lead singer goes and does his solo work.
They make the album, and then a year later, they break up again amidst revived tensions.
Exactly.
Really?
And get this, the quote here, during the 8-year split, so this is before the first time they broke up, Richard Ashcroft, the singer, dismissed talk of a reunion saying, "You're more likely to get all 4 Beatles on stage."
That's saying something right there.
Yeah, because I'm pretty sure half of them are dead.
And, you know.
I don't think George Harrison was dead at that time, was he?
Maybe not. It depends on when he said it. before we get into talking about the album.
John Lennon was definitely dead.
I want to talk about...
Paul's been dead for the longest time. Let's just get it. Can we get into that?
Yeah, he's been dead since the 70s.
Podcast?
Yeah,
that'll be...
And hologram technology has been around for a while, so that's what we've been seeing when he does these shows.
Well, okay.
We're letting ourselves get off track.
Yeah, we are.
One more thing I want to talk about before we get back into the band. The Verve... This is a conversation of one-hit wonder versus signature song. I was talking to some people about this last night. Because there are some other recognizable songs by The Verve. They were a relative success in the UK.
Yep.
Oh, sure.
So they have about 4 songs that were in the top 10 in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
Bittersweet Symphony is the only song of theirs that charted in the US. So I still consider that a one-hit wonder since we live in the USA.
That is
that
filter.
Fair?
Yeah. I hope so, because I chose it, so I feel like an asshole if I...
Yeah, no, we did it by the book. I looked that up before we...
Sure,
we did it.
I mean, far and away, Bittersweet Symphony is
their signature song.
Guaranteed.
Yep. Yes. If you were to go up to somebody and be like, if you knew a song by The Verve, what song would it be? 10 times out of 10. 9 times out of 10, Bittersweet Symphony. 1 time out of 10, The Drugs Don't Work, because Lizzie did that to me yesterday.
Yeah.
Lizzie's my roommate's girlfriend.
Aha.
Uh-huh. So, moving on.
How do we feel about the album? You think it's good?
I think it's good, and I'm happy that it's good, because 4 episodes in...
We haven't been reviewing a lot of good stuff. It's been mostly negative things to say.
I liked the Modern English album as well.
Did you?
Modern English?
We talked about that.
Right.
But I like this. MJ, what were your thoughts? I know you texted me 3 songs in. You're like, surprisingly not bad.
I don't hate it. I'm glad I don't hate it because I didn't even do the research for this podcast. I didn't want to have to make it as painful as it could have been. But actually, the first track was like... pretty decent, like it's heavy, but then
first track
Sit and Wonder, yeah. They have a lot of what I noticed is like there's a lot of like 7 to 8 minute songs that could have easily been 4 to five.
My thoughts,
like, dissonance.
Exactly.
But yes. I think what happens when you listen to it, you're like, oh, this is clearly an album made in Great Britain after Coldplay.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, like, it just feels like there's so many moments that hit, you know, that feeling of Coldplay, and not just from the stereotype of, like, hearing a British male voice sing, you know, rather high with guitar in the background. Doesn't make it like Coldplay, but I think the reason why they had so much dissonance in their songs and so much, like, space between things is because they didn't want to sound as tight as Coldplay, perhaps.
It's like
X and Y had been out by then. And
X and Y, my favorite album by them.
Really?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay, well, you are a trash person.
I'm in the minority on that, I realize. I have here, this album came out too late to be Oasis and too early to be Coldplay.
Ooh. Ooh. I think it's too late to be both. Because if you think about it, I mean, Coldplay was already pretty much Coldplay. Like, X and Y, they were already doing stadiums.
Oh, yeah, this is 2008. Yeah, that's totally right.
Because Rush of Blood to the Head was 2003.
Oh, yeah, I'm way off.
No, you're not way off. It's just like they... You know, a little too late for both is what it feels like.
And, I mean, worth noting that Coldplay is heavily ripping off U2.
Yeah,
so true. So there's U2 all over this record.
It's just, it's Britpop. It's Britpop by the numbers, kind of.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some more interesting aspects. There's, like, the longer song structures. There's more space.
Yeah, so
it's kind of atmospheric.
We're pointing out running time. It's about 64 minutes long. 11 tracks, and the shortest song is 4 minutes and 38 seconds, with one of them 8 minutes plus.
Yeah.
I think that's the one. What one is that?
That is Noise Epic.
Yeah.
Noise Epic is track 7. I'm going to play it right now.
One of my favorite songs on this album, I would say.
I really like it. Yeah. I thought it was about... Can you guys hear that okay?
Oh, yeah.
Cool. Okay. I really like the last 2 minutes of this song. It switches into something different. If it was, like, 3 minutes... shorter, it'd be fantastic.
Yeah.
This song kind of starts out with like a Noi vibe almost, the krautrock kind of, I mean the bass line's not quite as thumpy, but it kind of has that sort of repetitive driving rhythm. And then the back half, I think what you're talking about, they kind of give me a little bit of Sonic Youth vibes.
Almost. I was going to say the second half of it could be a good Strokes song.
Right.
One thing I did take note of, and maybe it's because I was walking around in the sun with clouds, is the cover of the album is actually very pretty.
Mm-hmm.
It's like all those giant clouds building, and I think there's something to the idea that each of these tracks do build, even though they are, I don't know, they take time and they go different places. I feel like they're like almost like building a cloud, like a storm is coming.
Yeah,
but also I was high listening to that, so I don't know.
We'll come back to this song in a second.
That's a surprise to anybody who's listening to this, but I may have been high while reviewing this album.
Do you think that made you like it more or less?
Always more.
Always more?
Yes and no. I mean, I feel like it's one of those things where it's not like everything's better when you're stoned. It's like everything that's good is great, and everything that's great is mind blowing, and everything that's mediocre just feels hollow. So you're kind of like, I'll skip to the next one. Mm-hmm. Like,
that's a good way to say. So that was the first minute of Noise Epic. I'll play something in the back half of it because it changes up a little bit. It's one of the few songs to have a lot of variety, I thought.
Yeah.
My biggest problem with this song is that when I see a 7-minute track length, I think that there's going to be some pretty disparate parts. On this album, the 7-minute songs are just 7 minutes of them playing one idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's accurate.
It's, if you think about it, like every time I see a 7-minute song, I'm like, psh, this better be Stairway. So it's got 3 songs in one right there.
Right.
You know, like,
when a 7-minute song is good, it's usually great. Because, that's a...
Impressive.
Yeah, it's impressive, and it has enough time to hit really hard.
Mm-hmm.
But on this, I just... a lot of hit potential if they would just trim it down. They write some really good melodies.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on. There's definitely a lot of, parts and... unique kind of ideas, somewhat unique, but it's just not really commercially palatable, I'd say. I mean,
it might be by design too.
You know,
if you think about Bittersweet Symphony got picked up in how many commercials, how many films, how many things. Like, it was on a Nike campaign, it was on just early cell phone things. It still gets used. That still same beat can get used, and everyone hears it and they know what it means. They're like, this is inspiring and sad somehow.
Yeah.
And, I was thinking, one thing we like to talk about on the show is if there's a song on the album that clearly was attempting to replicate the success of the hit.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, we usually get into that in the end, but I'm thinking of it right now, and I feel like there's no harm in doing so. Track three is entitled Rather Be.
That would be my choice.
And
as well.
It just has that same kind of, like, that piano right there. I feel like they knew they were onto something.
Well, and there's gonna be, yeah, there's strings, or I don't know. Yeah, there's strings in there, right?
What?
There are strings doubling that sort of.
I believe so. And so, yeah, the strings sort of make me think of Bittersweet Symphony as well.
Yeah. Just on the most surface level, harkening back to Bittersweet Symphony.
Yeah.
If there was one that was guilty of that, or you know, attributed to it, it would be this song. But even then, it's its own way, it's just a little different. This is the shortest one, too, isn't it?
It's close. It's 5 minutes and 37 seconds long, so it is the...
That's short for this album.
Second shortest. No, third shortest.
Okay. Maybe they were doing that for the sake of the movie. Cruel Intentions 4.
But what if they had just become that Cruel Intentions band?
I mean, hell, we have more albums.
Yeah, that's true. I wish they would have kept making them.
The Cruel Intentions house band.
What, Kyle, I know you said you're not much of a lyrics person. MJ, are you much of a lyrics person?
I am a big fucking lyrics person.
Okay.
It's weird, though. Like, I feel like I hear a song just like, you know, anybody else would hear it for the first time and be like, oh, I like the vibe of that. I like the energy of that.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to think of a positive instead of a negative way to say this. Nothing makes me happier than when I listen to the lyrics after I've heard the song or read the lyrics and find out that they are intrinsic to how the song feels to me. Mm-hmm. That makes me so fucking happy.
Yeah.
It really feels like it's a piece. It's like a pinpoint map of the, you know, a spot on the universe. Like, this is how this feeling is. This is what this emotion is. This is the kind of song you listen to before you do this. But I could say it negatively. It makes me just as upset when I will hear a great song or feel a good riff or hear something and I'll go and read the lyrics and they're just like, I don't know. Like, the Strokes, I feel like, became very guilty of that after, like, right after Room on Fire. Like, pretty much every album after that is just, like, some of the lyrics you listen to, you're like, what?
Mm-hmm.
Do any of these mean, you know, in some ways? But then you could also say the same thing about Rolling Stones or Radiohead, because, like, they both would do the thing, Mick Jagger and Tom York would do the thing where they have lyrics, but they don't have a song. So they'll rip up lyrics and put them in a hat and pull them out, and the order in which they pull them out were the way in which they'd sing the song. But, again, the lyrics themselves are kind of spacey, and so is the way they're delivered. So it's still a final piece.
Yeah.
So long story short, yeah, I'm a lyrics person.
Okay, I like that. I like that approach.
I love lyrics that match the vibe and the energy, not just we wrote a killer song and the writer just kind of, whoever it was, just stepped in and was like, oh, I could say these things that I wrote in a poem.
Yeah.
Whereas I'd love to hear a poem come to life. Is the better way to put it.
Sure, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, someone hears a poem and is like, man, that makes me want to play this guitar riff. Yeah.
So that being said,
yeah.
Did you pay much attention to the lyrics on this album at all? Did you look into them at all?
I didn't follow up much on it, just from what I had heard. There was, I think Valium Skies was the one. I just thought, I don't know, it's a little funny because I've never done Valium, but I can only imagine what it would be like.
Yeah.
And so him talking about having his Valium Skies just made it seem like, okay, you're not actually talking about skies that are like Valium. You're literally just talking about being high on Valium.
Yeah,
and looking at the sky.
Here's track 8, Valium Skies.
Here we go. Coming in at track 8.
Coming in track 8. This is Casey Kasem. That was a bad Casey Kasem. I'm really sorry.
Back.
We'll fix it in post. Track 8, Valium Skies.
Because I was listening to it, I'm like, this is just a song to be high to. And then I heard Valium Skies, and I opened my phone, and on my phone it said, Valium Skies. I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Okay. It's a song called Drug High. Like, oh, thanks.
So I wrote Oasis for this one.
Oh, I can see that.
This seems like an Oasis ballad with a little bit different vocals. Chris Martin, the singer of Coldplay, once cited Richard Ashcroft of The Verve as the greatest singer of all time.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. I would have cited Chris Martin.
Yeah. I think everybody would say Chris Martin, so that's... Maybe we should just be listening to The Verve?
I would not. I would say Tom York. That's just my own personal opinion. That's the love it or hate it sort of voice.
Yeah. No, that's a good real answer.
Yeah.
But there's, actually, speaking of U2 and all the people that were getting up in this grill of, one of my favorite quotes ever was U2, and Bono had said, and this is, I think, one of the greatest things Bono's ever produced out of his mouth. That may be another podcast, too. But Bono said, if music were a religion, I would be a zealot singing about redemption, and Tom York would be an angel singing about his demons. And I was like, fuck yeah.
Interesting.
All right.
So you just imagine the two of them, like, literally, like, think of the image of Bono with a fucking megaphone and a microphone that's, like, hanging from a, like, fucking ceiling, just screaming into the audience, whereas, like, Tom York is just quietly holding his microphone, just, like, struggling to deal with the emotions that he is, like, trying to share with, like, you know, an entire audience full of people.
Does anybody else hear Tom Petty in this right now?
Oh, yeah.
I hear a lot of Tom Petty. I didn't catch that the first time. It's got that kind of, like, that slow groove that he does.
Mm-hmm.
This is a cool song.
His voice,
this is
too. Yeah.
This has, like, some serious hit potential. And I
feel like this is the romantic comedy part of the movie where, like, they decide to, like, maybe they should break up and she's going to take that job in Seattle.
Yeah.
And he's going to stay.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, they're, like, she's in the van on the way to, like, the thing, and he's thinking about the image. You see the shots from earlier where they're eating ice cream and, like, kind of dipping it on her nose, you know, and they're, like, doing the laundry together, and, like, the one plucky friend catches them having sex, you know, like, all that's happening. Cuts to there, like, in the airport. This is that song. This is that song, basically.
This is, like...
Yeah. He comes down the escalator. She doesn't go on the
floor. Is the film from the 90s or the mid-2000s?
Yeah, in a post-9/11 world, you couldn't get away with a scene like that.
Fair enough. Yeah, they don't allow ice cream. Either. No ice cream in a post-9/11.
Nope, nothing. Okay, I want to take a second and pause here, and maybe this can become a recurring segment on the show, where we talk about the personal music habits of our guest.
Oh, my.
Would you consider yourself more of an album listener or a track listener?
Oh, album, for sure, but it depends on the...
There's not many of us left.
Well, here's the thing about it, is I'd love to be like, yeah, just, you know, I'd like to just take an hour and 12 minutes and put a fucking vinyl on, but really,
It's only an hour and 5 minutes long.
The truth is, you need tracks to make an album. Like, the forest for the trees sort of thing. Like, you hear a track which gets you excited, or you like the band already. Bands I really already love, it's just like, give me the whole thing. I would take the entire album. I want to hear it in order. I want to hear it as you designed it. But then there are, like, you know, random things you hear while you're, you know, at a bar or at work or something in a movie, and you come back and you, like, listen to it. And the problem with me and Spotify, or, like, any music app, is that I can listen to that and then listen to the next hit and listen to the next hit and get a gauge for the band, which is a really cool thing. But I think it directly affects how I interpret music now as a piece. So I feel like I go for the album, but it's usually in halves. Because you put that album and you're like, damn, this is a great first track. And then the third track is the one you really liked, which got you to listen to this band. And then track 5 or 6 is great, but then you're kind of peter-pattering out. And then you have a party, or you're playing it with a friend in the background, and then you get to, like, track 10, and you're like, damn, that's a really good song.
Yeah.
I don't listen to track 10 enough. I don't listen to the other half of that album. So then you start becoming obsessed with the last half of the album. You don't even listen to the first 6 tracks. You've heard them so many times.
Totally.
It's always like you wake up, you go get in the shower, listen to the same 4 songs, kind of done with it. And it's so rare, for me at least, when I find that. Because, like, sometimes there are just 6 great songs, and they're the first 6 songs. And the rest are just like, and these things.
It's, that very weird feeling when there's an album that you love the whole album, but it took you forever to come around to track 6.
Chunks of it, became a thing. I think Frank Ocean, Channel Orange.
Yeah, I don't even want to talk about Frank Ocean. Frank, if you're out there and you're listening, we are all very upset at you right now.
I'm not.
What did I tell you, man? I told you.
He'll do no wrong, in my opinion. The only thing he's done wrong is...
But anyways, what were you saying?
Yeah, well, that was one of those albums, too. Like, I think, like, that and, like, Good News People Who Love Bad News and Modest Mouse is the same thing, where, like, it was just the first couple tracks. I was like, fuck, I love these so much. I want to hear them over and over again.
Yeah.
And then it just got to be this place where I was like, oh, well, this is also really good. And then I think both of those albums I digested in thirds, actually. Because they both are actually around 15 or 16 tracks.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Channel Orange is like 70 minutes long.
Yeah.
It's big.
Oh, my God. It's a good. So I definitely an album person at heart. But I also know that there are times when you look to a band like The Verve.
Yeah.
Where you're like, I can listen to 2 tracks and, like, never have to think of them again.
It's funny that you bring up an album Reeling You In by the opener, because mm-hmm. Bittersweet Symphony was the opener.
It was.
On Urban Hymns.
Wow.
At 5 minutes and 57 yeah. seconds long. We listened to the radio edit at the beginning of the podcast. That's 4 minutes 38. Wow. The full version, 6 minutes long. It was the opener.
So
how do you even
they've
begin?
They've been doing this long song thing
yeah.
forever.
The last album is 70 minutes long. So this is...
Interesting.
This is worn down territory. Well-worn territory, I should say. But...
If you think about it, though, think about that perfect opening. The strings opening
oh, man.
Is perfect for the opening of anything.
I was saying one of the most inarguably ubiquitous moments of the 90s, musically.
Sure, yeah.
I think. Everybody knows it. Everybody
you
recognizes
hear
it.
It. Yeah.
That being said, how do you, 11 years later, try and open the next album? How would you even do that?
The way they did it, man.
Sit and wonder.
Yeah, just,
6 minutes and 52 seconds long.
It's kind of dark and a little more edge.
So imagine you're a Verve super fan.
Yeah.
It's 2008. Your fave band just got back together. They're releasing a new album.
You dusted off your old t-shirts.
Yep. You got this t-shirt on. You remembered listening to the opening of the last album. It was Bittersweet Symphony. You still love that song 11 years later.
It's your ringtone.
and this is it. This is your first taste of the next Verve album. What do you think?
We saw an unambiguous
yeah.
start.
Bittersweet Symphony took its time.
Yeah, right. It's almost like you're zooming back in on the band with the way this music starts. It's kind of like,
yeah,
our tale continues.
Since we last spoke, our heroes. Sick drum beat.
Oh yeah.
Great drum work. Great simple, like, he swings it a lot. Keeps me interested. It's kind of like that unintentional head nod feeling.
Oh yeah. This actually might be my favorite on this album.
What's up?
This might actually be the one song from this album that I hear and I'm like, oh yeah, I could get into this.
Yeah? So
all the songs I'd have to like push myself through.
Do you think this one justifies its 7-minute length? Do you think any of the songs justify their length?
I can't say.
And I know this is a little bit. This is a little harsh because they made this album for a reason. I figured out. I'm gonna pause this song. That was Sid and Wonder. A question I've been asking Kyle in the last couple episodes was how to determine what the band did afterwards. And I think I found. So like, I think I asked you, did they deserve to be a one-hit wonder? That was mean. That was pretty harsh. I think I have a way to phrase it now, though. This album did have a big hit that hit number 4 in the UK, Love Is Noise, track 2.
Mm-hmm, which we should listen to.
Which we'll listen to in a second, but I want to ask, are you surprised that they were a one-hit wonder in the US? Are you surprised that this album didn't come out and make a splash on US rock radio? Because there's hit potential here on a handful of these songs.
For sure, definitely. See, what I was going to say about Sit and Wonder here is I get U2 vibes, but I also get Radiohead vibes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I guess what that's going to lead me to say as an answer to your question is that I think across the pond over here, we had a lot of Radiohead exposure and a lot of U2 and a lot of Coldplay. This is a very, like, British band.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, they're very British. Richard Ashcroft, good friends with Noel Gallagher. I mean, it's just
super
like...
Super British name. Richard Ashcroft?
Yeah.
It's hard to say without an accent. Richard Ashcroft.
Yeah, he sounds like he produced Abbey Road.
Or goes to Hogwarts.
So, it's not that these songs... I mean, I think the songs are pretty good. They're really interesting to listen to. Like, they sonically sound great. I think maybe just a little bit of... Like, we're just a little saturated over here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think also it comes down to the fact that if you forget these other bands and you forget the idea of like, you know, British or not or whatever, like the album might be just fantastic. But if you, like you had even said it, like kind of a Radiohead vibe, this is 5 years after Hail to the Thief. This is the year in Rainbows came out.
Oh,
so
really? Yeah,
if you're talking about like, if you're talking about the reality of what they sound like or what they could be kind of paying homage to because of the area they're in or their influence, the people who are influencing them are also still working right now.
So why listen to the people being influenced?
Kinda, yeah. Or to a point where, like, and also In Rainbows is just 9 tracks of fucking gold, or 10 tracks of gold, like,
that's
in my opinion.
A great,
like,
no, you're right.
So it's kind of funny where you're like, yeah, I don't even think I remember hearing about this album coming out because I was obsessed with Radiohead.
Why would you listen to a band that sounds like Radiohead when you could listen to Radiohead?
And it sounds a little more like, oh, if you like U2, you know, Coldplay and Radiohead, I'm like, yeah, those are all bands. Some more than others, obviously one more than others, but I would, like, sure, I'll check that out eventually, but it's not gonna be like, oh god, I can't wait to hear you know, 3 people who are already doing very specific things blend into one. I don't know, like, but this what you asked earlier though, when it comes to deserving it, I think, yeah, maybe it's a better way of saying deserving, but you know what I mean, is I think this is the only one of the only tracks that does stay consistent throughout, aside from the one you played earlier.
Valium Skies?
No. Just the length of it. Noise Epic.
Noise Epic.
So Noise Epic and this one are the only two that, like, stay strong. The other ones, I feel like they get long and they get stretched.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I get a little fatigued.
A lot of them are kind of samey, you know? Like, in the middle of the album, it kind of ran together for me.
Yeah, same here.
It runs together. It's them having good ideas. These songs open up and I'm like, I like this. I like this riff. You're onto something here. And then that's just the idea they play with for 6 minutes. It just is a little tiring. Here's Love Is Noise, track 2.
Okay.
So this, again, hit number 4 on the UK charts.
First single, highest charting single, right?
Yes.
In the UK.
In the UK.
The vocals going here give me, they remind me of that M83 song that came out a few years ago that was in that Victoria's Secret
City
commercial. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Just because it's that repetitive sort of vocal. Yeah,
totally.
Oh, I never thought about that. I don't dig that kind of vocal thing. Like, I just, at first was like, what are they doing? And then I realized, like, oh, it reminds me so much, especially with the drum beat of Coldplay. Like, just so much so, and not to say, like, Coldplay's the end all be all, but because I keep going back to that, but I just feel like the difference is he tries to distance himself by not sounding as pretty as Chris Moore.
Right.
By going, like that's clearly audio, like, the audio is clearly, like, tweaked to sound like, like, instead of just a beautiful, nice voice, which would have been the Coldplay song. He's like, yo, let's change it a little bit. Let's make it a little bit darker. And then we'll be different.
But you can still tell, though, because the tone of Richard Ashcroft's voice, very different to Chris Martin's, but he sings with the same, is it intonation? Is that the word that I'm looking for? No, it's not. He sings with the same, the way he groups and phrases his words and, like, chooses a vocal melody, I find very similar. Like, if you imagine Chris Martin's tone singing this melody right now,
right,
you wouldn't be super surprised.
Very true. No, honestly, you could sum it up for me. But there's that right there. Maybe, like, a little Tom Waits at the end.
In the slide. Let this section ride out, because, like, where is the chorus in here exactly?
It was right there.
Right, but the only thing that really changed significantly was just the lyrics themselves.
The speed at which it talks.
So, again, talking about, I'm going to pause it here, listening to a band that sounds like somebody else as opposed to just listening to that band.
Mm-hmm.
Lyrically, this band is about on par with Coldplay, I would say. Nothing was painfully bad, but it was a lot of vague calls to action. Love is noise, love is pain.
Love is the blues I'm singing.
Love is the blues that I'm singing again.
Again. I'm Richard Ashcroft.
But that being said, if a band doesn't have, like, a singer with the star power of Coldplay, but we're getting the same lyrical quality, why not just listen to Coldplay? Hey, I like Coldplay more than most people. I'm just...
Right? It's... there is something to that. There's... Again, there's a difference between...
Enough.
Yeah, there's a difference between homage and just being similar. Again, like, rip-off just comes to the idea of, like, what you heard first. Because some of my...
Yeah.
Like you said, that Verve fan who's out there right now just, like, watching Cruel Intentions with his shirt up. Just
again, Venn diagrams, one circle.
That one Venn diagram, one dude chilling out. It's just waiting. And to them, they listen to that, and then someone's like, dude, oh, you're gonna love this album. Check this out. This is called Rush of Blood to the Head by Coldplay. You gotta listen to this. You'd be like, this is just fucking the Verve. You know what I mean? He's yeah. Like, you guys, they rip because you want to talk about this album is like ripping off all these things. But if you think about it, they were before Coldplay.
Yeah, you come to the Verve first. Before
fucking everybody. I mean, like, aside from Oasis or Radiohead, like they were before yeah. a lot of things with Coldplay or, you know.
I listened
to
another
British band and not sound like an asshole, but like One Direction. I don't know. But then, okay, think about this. Here's the other thing I thought about too. In 2008, at the time in Britain, what was getting tons of recognition and play and going around and actually having a bigger effect on America was Bloc Party and Arctic Monkeys.
Yep.
So you already have this neo, like, pop punk sort of, like, outfit that is just, like, literally all about cigarettes and sweaty white t-shirts.
Yeah.
And just banging out 2.5 minute songs and making a 16 track album. And some of the songs are as long as, like, 4 some minutes maybe or so. And that's Arctic Monkeys' first album. And then they released another one almost right around that same exact time, Famous Worst Nightmare, and they're tight and they're in the studio mm-hmm. and they've got a manager.
Much more polished.
Really, oh, yeah, it's gorgeous. And now you look at them now and you're like, oh, fuck, wow, okay.
Yeah, now Alex Turner's a cowboy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it is what it is. But what I mean to say is, like, that's what's happening. So, like, them coming back and picking up the mantle and being like, we're going to do our thing, but we're going to bring it to the new age. And then you look around and, like, I can see why people wouldn't give a fuck.
Yeah, the music listeners in that country at the time are mm-hmm. like, we have disillusioned, jaded people that are our age. Yeah. Why would we listen to you anymore?
Yes, and they're faster than you.
Yeah, they play, like, faster than you.
Bloc Party especially is just, like, lyrically and vocally just so... just so raw and beautiful and can take you to certain heights. And plus the band themselves are going to have carpal tunnel by the time they're 30, which yeah. they probably are now.
Talk about a band that fell from grace quick and hard.
Real hard.
Man, people hate that band now.
I see. I don't even think about it. I guess I haven't even bothered listening to other albums either because Silent Alarm is just there. But
yeah.
I just feel like at the time when this album came out, like, they were up against, and at least my, you know, own perspective picture, against Arctic Monkeys and Bloc Party, aside from, like, the old standards of, like, you know, Radiohead or Oasis. Like,
yeah.
So it's just that idea that, yeah, why would I listen to this if I chose to listen to it? Like, it's not a bad album. If you forget these other albums, this album's amazing.
With no context,
yeah,
it's a solid record.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I would say so, yeah.
But let's add some context
yeah.
as we get out of here. One last couple, or a couple more things. The album comes out, the band breaks up.
Yeah.
For 11 years, they come back, they make this album, they break up again. And I realize no artist does something without some reason to do it. And I know it's kind of maybe shitty to speculate otherwise, but do you feel that this record was necessary? Or did it tarnish the legacy that they left with Bittersweet Symphony?
Ooh. So if they just kind of like... dropped the mic, walked away.
Yeah, do you think that they would have left a better legacy for themselves if they never made the album? Because it did have a number 4 hit. It seemed like people realized that it came out and liked it.
Yeah.
But, like, the band hated each other while they were making it and then broke up again.
I think the controversy, or since it's British, the controversy...
Thank you.
Surrounding the lawsuits and yeah. the millions and millions of dollars that the Rolling Stones got... And the fact that this artist now has to share his name with two, you know, yeah, if you're going to share your name and writing credits with, like, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, like, that's probably pretty cool. If you, again, forget contextually, that's because you're paying the millions of dollars for the song that you wrote and yeah. worked your ass off for, even though they just sampled something from a sample. But either way, if they would have just walked away after that, everyone now, we'd be looking back and being like, yeah, well, they got fucked. They got fucked so hard, and they were like, screw the system, I'm going to leave, I'm not going to do this. I'm not gonna make an album. We're never gonna work together again. You'd think about the Beasts, but instead we think about this album. It's like they kind of made themselves vulnerable again by getting back together and doing it. So I think I respect the fact that they made another album. I liked the fact that they came through amidst the controversy,
yeah.
however you say it, and it makes the conflict they have with one another artistically to make something that was their own. I respect that and think okay. it's cool for that reason. But I do think that had they walked away after that and Bittersweet Symphony was just the mic drop, also the mic pick up at the same time,
yeah. you know,
at least to Americans, yep. it would be it'd be more of like a dramatic story. Like kind of like Blind Melon. Like they,
okay.
you know, they released their album and they were like touring internationally and then releasing
Shane and Noon yeah, ODs, right?
The OD, but before that he peed on the front row of
Jesus audience Christ.
At one of his shows because it was a bad show and they noticed he was too high to perform, so he showed them how high he was and peed on them. Sued by, like, everyone at that sure. fucking concert. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously throwing his life down the drain in that way, but, like, to a degree, yeah, I think... I'm glad they made this album. I
okay.
think that they... I don't think it hurt their legacy. I think it showed that they could be more than just Bittersweet Symphony. Is what they wanted to do, I'm guessing.
Awesome. That's probably them succeeding in what they were hoping to do. Get out of the shadow a little bit.
Yeah.
Kyle, anything to add?
I guess I am definitely vibing with what you were saying right there. Like, it's definitely not Bittersweet Symphony. You know?
No.
It's far removed from that, and it's its own statement, for better or for worse. It's definitely like worth listening to, I would say. You know?
Yeah. Some of these melodies clearly capture some magic that can only be made by, like, tension among members. Like, that just makes good art. That's a time-tested strategy.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, it doesn't capture the magic that Bittersweet Symphony did. But, you know, it's a good album in its own right. It doesn't try to be that song, like you said.
Right, and I also want to say that it doesn't try too hard to go away from the idea of Bittersweet Symphony. Because, like, some bands come up and they're like, oh, I fucking hate that song. I'm going to go as far away as possible.
Crazy Town.
Crazy Town. Oh, man.
Which we did on episode 2.
Oh.
That was bad.
Oh, why? Why would you? Did they make another
Lizzie
album?
Chose it.
Yeah, our guest chose
How
it.
How many albums did they make?
I made three.
What was the last one?
It's very interesting because...
I guess I could just go to the state fair in any county and find out.
Right.
The Brimstone Sluggers is the third album.
Made what? Like 13 years. What was it? 13
yeah,
years after?
Something like that. Not the point.
Do they still work out?
They're still together.
They still
no, I mean
left.
Like physically.
Yeah, they left.
Do they still work out? Because they all look ripped.
Any other final thoughts?
Just as directly as possible, would you recommend this album to other people?
Yes.
I would say listen to it so you can understand the context of this podcast.
That's where you're going to...
No, I'm just being an asshole.
Well, because we do, yes, listen
yeah,
to it. But.
Yeah. No, I would say... yeah, honestly, I wouldn't. I can't walk away from it. Be like, this is a terrible album. I'm so upset with myself for choosing that fucking song. But I wouldn't. I'm not gonna be like, dude, you have to hear this.
I would say yes with some caveats. Yeah, I'd be like, you should listen to this. I mean, it's not the best Brit rock album in the world, but there's some good ideas on it.
Right.
It is that thing of like, oh hey, you like these bands? Like you said earlier, like
maybe
oh,
check
you
this
like,
out. You might
like
find something
you
like.
You like all these guys, and also you don't have any content of theirs right now.
Right.
So check this out while you're it's a little diet soda version.
Totally. Same thing for me. I wouldn't be like, whoa, guys, have you heard
Rush
Ford
over
by The Verve? Because you need to listen to it right now. But like if it came up and it was like, yeah, actually, you know, the album they did after that was actually pretty decent. Check it out.
Yeah. Because I'm sure this is just going to come out sometime at a bar. Someone's like, oh, they fucking nothing happened to them after. Be like, actually, technically, Love is Noise. excuse me. There's a touch tunes in the corner. I'll give you a few samples.
Honey, can I borrow a couple dollars to
play
some Verve on the touch tunes?
Oh, there you go. This is like I would say listen to this album just so you can be the person who makes a playlist for somebody and uses the Verve and does not use Bittersweet Symphony.
Yeah.
Because you're going to blow their fucking mind.
Break that streak of people only putting Bittersweet Symphony in for playlists.
For sure.
Okay.
Also break the streak of making it last on a playlist. You know, make it first.
Yeah, make it the opener,
like
the band intended.
Exactly.
MJ, thank you for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
This is a lot of fun.
Totally. Sorry I swore so much, people.
No, that's fine. This is ranked explicit on fucking iTunes, so they know what they're in for.
Oh, good.
But I do want to, before we get into, I want to let you plug some stuff in a sec here, but I just want to say... This episode branched out a little bit more. And I'm happy that it did. We talked about like the music habits of MJ, our guest.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. I think that's a thing that can come back.
Absolutely.
And this wasn't the funniest episode. It's not always going to be. It's informative first. And
whoa,
I think you learned about...
Oh, what the fuck? I thought I was killing
no,
it over
we,
here.
This was the most. This
the
was
laughter.
The most informative one yet.
Okay,
I had a true joy talking about this record and this
Should
band
I?
And where they stand in history. And like getting into Radiohead and all the connections and influences.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun to talk about. And sometimes it's going to be that, and
I think I should leave with a joke now. Jesus.
People who are enthusiastic about music are going to like this podcast because we're enthusiastic about music.
Totally.
And it was great to talk about. onehitwonderfulworld@gmail.com if you have any suggestions, comments, bands you want to hear talked about. We'll be happy to sift through those. Kyle and I will be back next week. We're going to be talking about Natalie and Bruglia.
Oh, see, that was my other choice.
Her hit song was Torn.
I can't wait.
It's going to be... I think I'm going to love it. Kyle's probably not.
You know, I was going to go for Nelly Furtado, but she actually had a couple of jams.
She did.
She did.
She did well for herself.
Also, I was thinking, who was the chick who sang Sunny? Sonny came home with
Sean Colvin.
Oh, damn it. See, all right. Can I come back, guys?
Oh, absolutely. Sometime. We would love to have you again. Do you have anything you want to plug before we get out of here?
Oh, I'm with an improv group called Bearded Men.
Heard of them?
You probably haven't. The Venn diagram of one. But now we beardedmenimprov.com. We have a group in LA and a group here in Minneapolis.
You guys are going on a tour soon,
yeah,
correct?
We leave on Friday. We're going on tour. We're going on a national tour. We're going to be all over the place. LA, Vegas, Austin, Atlanta, Denver, Raleigh, Des Moines. Hey. Yeah, we're hitting all the hot spots.
So I'm not sure where our listeners are located, but go to beardedmenimprov.com.
Yeah, the list of the tour dates there. And if not, if you're ever in Minneapolis or LA, every weekend you can catch one of our shows.
I can speak personally to the quality of the shows. They're fantastic. Kyle, have you been?
I haven't.
You have not?
I'll be looking forward to one.
We're going
to
amend that soon.
This had I known.
We're going to amend that soon.
You're all good.
Well, all the best of luck on the tour. Thanks, we will have you again on the show soon. It was a pleasure having you here.
I want to listen to Sunday Came Home.
We're
gonna just play me out.
Well, we'll do that after we close with, you know what? Let's do track 6. This is I See Houses by The Verve off the album 4th. This has been another episode of One Hit Wonderful World, and we will see you next week. Thank you very much.
I love that name.
Bye, thanks. Well, I kind of like the song too.
Lives will outweigh. How many tears must I take?